Lord, open our eyes to see wonderful things in your law, in your truth. Bring them home to us, make them real to us, that we may live in a way that pleases you, for Jesus' sake. Amen. If you could turn back to 2 Kings chapter 11, our first reading, that would be a good start. You'll find it at page 381. It's the second Sunday before Advent. As I walked down the road in London the other day, there was a house with lights in the garden, a blow-up Father Christmas, absolutely everything already there, and a couple of workmen nearby said, "It's a bit early, isn't it?" To which I agreed. But nearly Advent, getting ready for Christmas. That's why we're in 2 Kings chapter 11. You look puzzled. I wonder if you can see the connection. One of the commentaries that I read entitled this chapter, "The Lady Who Saved Christmas." There's another lady in this story who's not very ladylike, who was out to destroy Christmas. Two ladies whose connection to Christmas may not be obvious at first glance. So I'll give you a clue. 2 Samuel 7, verses 12 and 13 at page 311, has a promise to David. Verses 12 and 13 of 2 Samuel chapter 7. "The Lord declares that the Lord will establish a house for you, David. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I'll raise up your offspring to succeed you, who will come from your own body, and I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." And the same thought comes elsewhere in the Bible. I can find you a number of passages, but if you go to Psalm 89, verses 34 to 37, at page 598, you get the same idea. "I will not violate my covenant, says God. Once for all, I've sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His line will continue forever, and his throne endure before me like the sun, established like the moon, the faithful witness in the sky." So have you got it? Jesus, Messiah, was to be of the line of David. And if the line of David, his descendants, were destroyed, where then will the Messiah come from? You remember the line goes to his son, Solomon. There are then four more kings of Judah. There's a split of into two kingdoms, Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And then we come to this man called Jehoram. And all these kings are of a piece. It's said of all of them that they followed either the ways of Ahab or the ways of Jeroboam. Ahab, you recall, was the king of Israel, who with his pagan wife Jezebel had reintroduced the fertility cult of the Baals. Jeroboam had introduced the worship of bulls or calves. You remember the golden calf, way back in Exodus, the same thing coming back again, in accordance with many of the Middle Eastern religions, worship of bulls or calves. As a political move, no doubt, Jehoram, now the king of Judah, married one of Ahab's daughters, Athaliah. And she was a very strong influence on him, in much the same way as Ahab had been influenced by his pagan wife Jezebel. But if you read the previous few chapters here, you'd find a very inglorious story. When Jehoram came to the throne, he decided that having six brothers was having six brothers too many. So he promptly eliminated the lot as soon as he got his feet under the table. And he's yet another in this line of unrighteous kings who are unfaithful to Yahweh and who promote idolatry. And then if you were to go over into Chronicles, where you find the chronicler telling the same version of events, but giving you some further details, we find this. We find that Philistine and Arab invaders raid Jehoram's palace. They carry off not just booty, lots of goodies, but also all his wives and all his sons, except one, the youngest, Ahaziah. And there's a reason that lies behind that. Because if Ahaziah had been destroyed, there would be no line of David. So if you were to go to 2 Chronicles, chapter 21, it's page 454. If you want to follow it, make sure I'm saying the right things. Please do. But you will discover there that in 2 Chronicles, chapter 21, verse 6 and 7, we have this. Because of the covenant the Lord had made with David, the Lord was not willing to destroy the house of David. He promised to maintain a lamp for him and his descendants forever. But Ahaziah, the only surviving son of Jehoram, was no better than any of his predecessors. And in due course, he gets his comeuppance too. And he gets his comeuppance from a man called Jehu, who might be thought of as the Lewis Hamilton of the chariot world. You recall the story of Jehu, who drives furiously in his chariot and is recognizable as a result. But Jehu revolts against the king of Israel and kills him, and then kills Ahaziah, the king of Judah, for good measure. He takes power in Israel, and he leaves Judah to sort itself out. And that leaves Athaliah, the queen mother, if you like, who decides that she will take over power. And in an effort to secure her own position, sets out to destroy whatever is left of the royal family. You'll recall Ahaziah had been the only one left, and so the only lot she can find to destroy are her own grandchildren, which she promptly does. You may have read or heard of David Walliams' book, The Gangster Granny. Well, she has nothing on this person, Athaliah, who is well prepared to destroy whatever's left of family in order to exalt her own position. Here is the woman who is trying to destroy Christmas, to ensure there is no son of David, no lineage left, who could survive to be the king of God's people. She will be in charge. And that brings us really to the first point of this passage as I see it. The hatred of the world. You see, this is what is to be expected of secular powers, particularly those of a despotic nature. They set themselves against God and against the people of God. There's an instinctive hatred for those whose primary loyalty lies elsewhere, who acknowledge a king, a lord from a different place, and I'm not afraid to live by that loyalty, whatever the cost. That's what we should expect. And do we see here a foreshadowing of Herod and his attempts to wipe out the one whom he saw as his rival, the son of David, Jesus? And we see it today all over the world, in Sudan, in Indonesia, in Iraq, in Syria, in northern Nigeria, in Indonesia, and any number of other places, attempts to extinguish the people of God. And that's what Jesus told us to expect. It'll come up on the screen in a minute. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belonged to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world. I chose you out of the world. That's why the world hates you. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant's greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. The hatred of the world. Secondly, the destructive effect of disobedience. I wondered if you picked up how devastating the effect was of Jehoram marrying the wrong person, Athaliah. It was the same for Ahab, who married Jezebel. It was the same for David and Solomon, who married foreign wives, and particularly the effect on their children. The Old Testament forbade marriage to godless spouses and was full of warnings that marrying the wrong person would result not just in tensions in the relationship between the husband and wife, or in trouble for the God-fearing spouse, in drawing them away from their walk with God, but particularly in the disastrous effect of their children being drawn away from the Lord. And the point holds true today, not just in marriage, but in any binding relationship of any kind, in business as well as family context. And what we find is Paul making exactly the same point, forbidding God's people to be unequally yoked to unbelievers. You'll recall, of course, that Paul gives very sage pastoral advice to those who've become Christians since marriage, and to those who are married to not yet believing spouses, on how to cope in such a situation, which isn't easy and requires great grace and great wisdom. But the impact on children is very hard to counter indeed. Anyway, if you want to know more, I've given you some references. There you are, 1 Corinthians 7, Ephesians 5 and 6, and 1 Peter 3, where both Peter and Paul give some good advice as to how to live in such difficult circumstances in a way that pleases God. And many people are in that situation, and God helps them in it. So the destructive effect of disobedience. Thirdly, the importance of faithful servants. So here we come to the lady who saved Christmas. Her name is Jehosheba. I wonder how many of you could have named her before coming this morning. I certainly haven't recalled much about her until I came to look at this passage. She's a daughter of Jehoram, probably not by Athaliah. So she's probably a half-sister of Ahaziah, the king who was killed. But she's married to a priest called Jehoiada. And she's cut from a different cloth from the rest of them. She grabs the one-year-old son of Ahaziah, Joash by name, who is with all the other princes, all the grandchildren who are about to be murdered, and she hides him, initially in a bedroom, or as Josephus, a Jewish historian, tells us, in a linen cupboard. And the nanny, or nurse, is taken with him from the palace to live in the temple, which is in fact where Jehosheba lives with her husband, the priest Jehoiada. And they bring up this child in secret in the temple for 6 years. And there is the influence of a godly adoptive family. Parents committed to bringing up kids in the house of God, in the family of God, in the presence of God. You know what? We never hear of Jehosheba again. And I say, I doubt if many of us would have remembered her name. But there was only one child left in the Davidic line. And if he'd been killed, along with the others, Joseph, Jesus' legal adoptive father, wouldn't have existed. Nor Mary, if she was part of the Davidic line, Jesus' mother. Though I'm inclined to think, in fact, she was probably from the tribe of Levi, because she was a cousin of Elizabeth, who was married to a priest. You may want to discuss that and come to a conclusion about that afterwards. Uncertainty abounds there. But at all events, Jehosheba, of whose existence you may well have been unaware or have forgotten, she's the lady who saves Christmas, because she saves this son of David. And in doing that, she plays her part in God's purposes. And what we see here is the Lord has his servant in the right place, at just the right time, to do the very thing that is needed for his plan to be worked out. She's a spoke, isn't she, in a much bigger wheel, a cog, part of the Lord's cosmic jigsaw. And so are you, and so am I. You don't need 15 minutes of fame to be a faithful servant of God, to fulfill your part in the Lord's purposes. So don't think your role is insignificant just because you never do anything as dramatic as Jehoshaphat did. If you're faithful in the place that the Lord has put you, take the opportunities that he gives you to serve him, to care for his people, to support his servants, to nurture your family, to bring them up in the fear of the Lord, and go on protecting and praying for them. That's the service that he's looking for. Your faithful service is important. It counts in his eyes. So the hatred of the world, the destructive effect of disobedience, the importance of faithful servants, and finally, the unstoppable kingdom. The unstoppable kingdom. Athaliah thinks she's won. She's ruling the land. Throughout this 6 years, there is, however, an unseen king, Joash, being brought up in the temple. There are two kingdoms in existence. One is the visible rule exerted by the secular power, a ruthless woman pursuing her own megalomaniac ambitions and plans. And the other is the invisible influence of the rule of a figure in the house of God, ignored by Athaliah and the others. The usurper Athaliah is apparently on the throne, but the true king will come into his own and is already attracting loyalty to himself and for what he stands. So do you see again the prefiguring of Jesus in all this? Joash and perhaps Jehoiada together are the prefigurement of God's coming priestly king, the instigator of a fresh covenant between the people and God. Did you notice the covenant here and the emphasis on it? There were two covenants. There was a covenant between God and his people, and there's a covenant between the king and his people. Just look at verse 12. So I've lost the point in terms of some of the passage. 2 Kings 11, and look at verse 12. Jehoiada brought out the king's son, put the crown on him, presented him with a copy of the covenant, and proclaimed him as king. Same again in verses 17 and 18. Jehoiada then made a covenant between the Lord and the king and people that they would be the Lord's people. He made a covenant between the king and the people. If you want to know what the covenant was, there's plenty of evidence as to the nature of it in 1 Samuel 10, verses 17 to 25, and in particular in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 to 20, which tell you what the king's responsibilities were to be and how he should act. It's the origin, in fact, of the queen. The king in this country receiving at that coronation a copy of the Bible, the covenant with the law, which the king had to abide by just as much as the people. And the renewed covenant here involves rededication to the Lord, the destruction of idols, the Baals, and judgment on those who prevailed against the authority of the Lord. Why? Because this is an exclusive covenant between God and his people. The Lord brooks no rivals, no other gods, no idols. Nothing takes precedence to him. And I wonder if the irony struck you of Athaliah shouting, "Treason, treason!" when she discovers that the true king is being crowned and she, the usurper, is being put in her place. It's not quite as funny, perhaps, as Kenneth Williams' infamy, infamy, they've all got it in for me, when they carry on up Pompeii or whatever it was called. I can't remember which one it was. But there's undoubtedly an irony in that which we're meant to see. He accuses those who support the true king of treason. It makes us smile, but it's also meant to ram home the point, I think, that we are guilty of treason ourselves if we don't give our total loyalty to our king, the true king, Jesus the king, whose kingdom's already come invisible, but who will come again in visible form. The first time he came in reconciliation, next time he comes in judgment to put the world to right and put its powers in perspective. So David's line, which appears to be hanging by a thread, continues as the Lord works out his plans for the king who is to come. And that kingdom is unstoppable because it's part of God's promise, God's covenant. And that kingdom has begun in us. Those who render him faithful service, who realize the destructive effects of disobedience, who face the hatred of the world, but in the assurance of his reign and of our reign with him, his kingdom will prevail. There will come a time, as we read in Revelation, when the apocalyptic visions become reality and songs will be sung about Jesus our King and his kingdom. So we see in Revelation these words we read. The angel sounds his trumpet, voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign for ever and ever." And this also in Revelation 5, verse 9. Talking of the elders and the living creatures who sing this new song, "You are worthy," talking of Jesus, "to take the scroll and open its seals, because you were slain. With your blood you purchased men from God, for God, from every tribe and language and people and nation. You've made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on earth." That's us. That's our future that God promises for us.